loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, for a second Friday in a row, Israeli forces are killing Palestinians for protesting for the right to return to their land. At least 7 Palestinians have been killed today already, with another 700-plus wounded. One of the dead is a 16-year-old boy, and at least 31 children have been wounded as Israel refuses to change its open fire rules and pummels the protesters with live ammunition and high-velocity bullets. Next, Saeed Vassal was well-known to residents and police alike in his Brooklyn, New York neighborhood as a harmless, mentally ill man who danced on the sidewalks and played with all types of items that he found on the street. But 2 days ago, someone allegedly called 911 to report that Vassal was pointing something that looked like a gun at passersby. It wasn't a gun. It was a shower head. Police arrived, and within 6 seconds, Vassal was shot and killed. The community is furious and has been rising up in protest. Then, thousands of Arizona teachers took to the streets yesterday, threatening to go on strike if the state legislature doesn't improve teacher pay and working conditions, reduce class sizes, and purchase new textbooks and equipment. Teachers in Arizona are among the worst paid in the country. And then 3,100 employees of Google have signed a letter protesting the company's involvement in a Pentagon program that uses artificial intelligence to interpret video imagery that could be used to improve the targeting of drone strikes, or what Secretary of Defense James Mattis calls the lethality of the U.S. military. And finally, we continue our conversation of yesterday about Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and personal data. Did Cambridge Analytica impact the 2016 election? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to Gaza. For a second Friday in a row, Israeli forces are killing Palestinians for protesting for the right to return to their land. At least 8 Palestinians have now been killed, with another 700-plus wounded. One dead is a 16-year-old boy, and at least 31 other children have been wounded as Israel refuses to change its open-fire rules and pummels the protesters with live ammunition and high-velocity bullets. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and the newly released book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5.
John, you know, before we jump to Miko, the numbers that you gave, those are just from today.
That's just from today.
Last Friday, the Israelis shot with live ammunition over 750 people.
That's right.
Anyway, Miko Peled, you know the story better than anybody, perhaps. Tell us what's going on.
Well, it's a catastrophe that's been going on for 7 decades. And really what is happening over the last couple of weekends, while is horrifying, is really not news. It's really nothing new. This is part of on the one hand, the very legitimate uprising, Palestinian uprising, a very legitimate demand to be allowed to return to their homes, a very legitimate demand to break down these artificial barriers, which are not really international boundaries, but are more like a prison wall, which Israel built around the Gaza Strip. And actually, the entire Gaza Strip as an entity is nothing but a prison. And then on the other hand, the brutality of Israel, which is, again, is nothing new, where orders are shoot to kill. And that's exactly what they're doing. And they do it with very well, and they do it without remorse. And they have no intention of stopping because they're trying to present the Gazans as some kind of mad Arabs who are trying to break down an internationally recognized boundary, which, of course, it's not.
Yeah, and when we looked at the U.S. corporate-owned media, I mean, again, 750 people shot last Friday, more than that, actually. 750 in a few hours. I don't know any other government in the world.
No, that's pretty amazing. The numbers are staggering.
You know, and it's like the headline, I saw one of the headlines, I don't know if it was Fox News or something, Hamas-inspired riot leads to clash or something like that. I mean, it's so disgusting. I mean, again, Miko Peled, what other government in the world gets away with shooting 750 civilians in one day and it's like no big deal?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer to that. But I think, again, if we look at, you know, I follow the Twitter, the IDF spokesperson Twitter, and all these, gatekeepers and racists like Dory Gold and others who are, you know, the protectors of the line of legitimizing of the Israeli crimes. And they're trying to portray this as some kind of a Hamas conspiracy, some kind of Hamas. First of all, Hamas is a legitimate resistance organization. Hamas was legitimately elected to be in the Palestinian or the small PA government. But there is nothing wrong with Hamas resisting. Hamas is a resistance organization. And some of the assumption that there will be no uprising, that Palestinians would not rise in March and stand up at, and try to fight this this oppression, try to fight this wall, try to get away from this horrifying prison, which has been in existence for 7 decades. The Palestinians would not show a desire to go back to their homes and back to their land, which lie right beyond those boundaries, those borders that Israel has built up, has erected, is absurd. It's got nothing to do with Hamas. Palestinians rise because Palestinians rise, because people rise, you know. Somebody asked me yesterday, you know, why do they keep doing it, knowing full well that they're going to be killed? Well, Palestinians are being killed anyway. It's not like they don't get killed when they're sleeping in their beds. Palestinians get killed all the time. Children in Gaza have the highest rate of kidney failure in the world because there's no access to clean water. You know, Israel is killing people in Gaza, not only using bullets, but using other means like no access to health care or medical care, and like depriving them of clean water and so forth. So it's an ongoing attempt to kill the people in Gaza in many different ways. And people rise because they're fed up and they want to go home.
Yeah. What's Israel's goal?
Israel's goal is to keep the world thinking that it's okay to kill people in Gaza because they have to do something with Gaza. Just letting it sit there and fester is embarrassing. You know, is embarrassing. People are going to ask questions. Why is this going on? So one option would be to let them free, allow the refugees to return, pay them compensation for 7 decades of suffering, pay them restitution, and rebuild Gaza and let people live as human beings deserve to live. But Israel doesn't want them back. They're Arabs. So the other option is killing them and blaming them for being terrorists. And it seems to be working very well. And Israel's been doing that for 7 decades and getting away with it. That's the aim. The aim is to make sure that nobody looks at Gaza and says, well, Israel has a responsibility and Israel's legitimacy. Israel has no legitimacy because the existence of the state of Israel came at a price of the suffering of all these millions of people. And therefore, this has to be reversed. And there should be no state of Israel. And there should be a real democracy with equal rights. And there should be restitution paid and given to all these refugees. And their right to return to the homes and the land is a sacred right which must be respected and has to happen. It's something that has to be materialized. But, of course, that's Israel's biggest fear. It's the breaking down of its own legitimacy.
And, Miko, is the end game for the Israelis really just to keep killing them until they give up?
It's to keep killing them, period, because killing them is good for business. As long as Israel can keep killing them and blame them, then they're doing fine. The end game is this. The end game is that Israel is in control, that Palestinians have no power, have no voice, have no say. That's the end game, just to keep things as they are.
Let's talk about just the allocation of resources in the West Bank, in Gaza, in historic Palestine. You've discussed this with us before on the show, like access to water, for instance, access to the things that people need to live. What's the Israeli policy on that?
Well, by and large, the Israeli policy for the last 7 decades, and you know, 7 decades is important. Israel is now going to celebrate its 70th Independence Day, which means 7 decades of Palestinian suffering. And from the very beginning, you know, they talk about the Nakba, the catastrophe, is something that happened in 1948. I would argue that the Nakba began in 1948, and this catastrophic reality for Palestinians has been going on for 7 decades. And part of it is genocide, plain and simple genocide, and it's easy to, you know, as it's defined, you know, by the Geneva Convention. Part of it is ethnic cleansing, again, as it is defined in international law. And the other part is maintaining a regime of apartheid against the Palestinians who are still there. Now, when we look at the genocide part, there's many ways to kill people, and denying them water is one of them. In the Negev Desert, which makes up really half or even more than half of the entire country, the Palestinian Bedouins are Israeli citizens. Yet they have no access to water or services. And again, when we look at cases of diseases that we don't see among Israeli Jews, that are a result of a lack of access to clean water, as a result of no access to medical care, as a result of no access to ambulances and roads and so forth, We can see that it's not only Gaza. This is happening to Palestinians everywhere. Wherever Palestinians are ruled by Israel, they live in horrible conditions. And the Palestinians who are not ruled by Israel, who live in camps, are prohibited from returning to their homes because of Israel. So either which way we look at it, Israel has created a catastrophe. And it continues with this catastrophe, and it will continue as long as people maintain this claim, maintain this notion that the state of Israel is a legitimate entity. And that is exactly the problem. That's exactly where we need to, I think, to fight the hardest, is to make sure people understand there is no legitimacy to the state of Israel. And the international community needs to act swiftly, even to the point of sending aircraft carriers to force the siege on Gaza to end and provide urgent humanitarian care to the people who live there.
Miko Pellet is our guest. Miko, you were born in Jerusalem. You were in Israel, or are an Israeli citizen. Your father was a general in the Israeli military. People who hear somebody, anybody say, well, Israel shouldn't exist as an entity, the argument will always be made that whoever says that is trying to, quote, drive the Jews into the sea or carry out another genocide on top of the Holocaust of the European Holocaust of the 1930s and 40s. But you're from Israel, you're Jewish, but you're making the argument that there's another way, that there's a different way, that Israel not existing means something other than genocide. It means actually democracy, where Arab and Jew, or Palestinian Muslim and Jew and Christian live together. Is that what you're demanding? Is that what you're fighting for?
Well, absolutely. The only people who think that ending the existence of the state of Israel means killing Jews are Zionists, are people who support the state of Israel and want to create some kind of panic. That is not the conversation anybody else has. The people who are fighting to create a real democracy in all of Palestine, from the river to the sea, talk about living as equals. Nobody talks about the expulsion or the killing of anyone. What was discussed is ending the privilege that I have over my Palestinian friends, privilege that allows me to travel freely, to have access to water, to have access to every resource that I could possibly want, have access and have the legitimacy as a citizen. In other words, I can live there, I can return, I can come, I can go, I can buy a house, I can do anything I want, which Palestinians who were born in Jerusalem, like me, have no right. They can't do.
I'm sorry that I have to cut you off, Miko. We're completely, totally out of time. We're joined from Washington by Miko Pellet. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he's also the author of the newly released book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Saeed Vassal was well known to residents and police alike in his Brooklyn, New York neighborhood as a harmless, mentally ill man who suffered from bipolar disorder. He danced on the sidewalks and played with all types of items left on the street. But 2 days ago, someone allegedly called 9/11 to report that Vassal was pointing something that looked like a gun at passersby. It wasn't a gun, it was a shower head. Police arrived, and within 6 seconds, Vassal was shot and killed. The police fired more than 10 bullets. He was unarmed. The community is up in arms. They've been in the streets for the past couple days. We're joined from New York by Kirby Joseph. She's an activist and organizer deeply involved in the issue of human rights and social justice, and she's been there in the streets with that community. Kirby Joseph, welcome.
Hi.
What's it been like the last couple of days in Brooklyn? And just to help the audience, because we're here in Washington, D.C., but the show plays all around the country and indeed all around the world. What kind of neighborhood is it? What's the reaction from the people there?
So the neighborhood that Saeed is from, that he's been all his life with his family, is Crown Heights in Brooklyn. He was murdered on Montgomery Street and Utica Avenue. That area is mostly Caribbean folks and immigrant workers. Myself, I lived in Crown Heights my whole life. But gentrification is showing itself really strongly in that community. And so when he was murdered at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, the community stayed out there from 5 p.m. folks who saw everything that happened. And like what you were saying before, the whole community knew who Saeed was, knew him by name. He ran errands for people in the neighborhood. He had his home in the neighborhood. The media wants to paint that he was homeless and didn't have a place to live in. Well, that's one of the things that his family wanted to make clear, that he grew up there. He lived there. His family lived there. And everyone knew him. So people were on the streets from Wednesday afternoon to Wednesday evening. Myself and other members of the Party for Socialism and Liberation were first responders with other police brutality movement organizers. And we built with the family. We spoke to the community. And a community that's set up with police brutality, with police harassment, which is heavy in that area, especially where Saeed was murdered, there's about two precincts, the 77th and the 71st, that are a few blocks away that are constantly occupying the community. Yesterday at the action, and I know we'll get to this later, it was even more powerful because, yes, we had organizations, and our organization was one of the leading organizations organizing this action, but the community was out in full strength.
Yeah. I'm looking at Time magazine, Kirby. Vassil's father, Saeed Vassil, he's the man who was shot dead by the police. He was unarmed. He was carrying a shower head, it appears. His father's name is Eric. He told reporters after the shooting that his son had been hospitalized several times for psychiatric problems, some involving encounters with the police, but that Saeed was polite and kind. And then the father is quoted, quote, "Police had a choice. They always have a choice. They should not train them to kill. They should train them to protect life, to save life," Eric Vassil said in an interview with WABC-TV. I mean, that's the fundamental point. They're not trained to save lives, though. They're trained to kill. I mean, they have a license to kill. There's impunity.
Yes, like police are agents of the state. They're there to protect property and not the people that live in the communities that they occupy. And it's very interesting how people in the community had a far better way of tactics in dealing with, you know, conflict than the police did. The community was saying, you should have done this, you should have done that, instead of killing them. And one of the messaging that we made clear was that police do have impunity, that they can kill and harass and sexually assault anyone in our community, and they do it every day, and they probably won't face any criminal punishment. But if it's any one of us, even for the most minor offenses, poor working class people are hit with jail time all the time.
Yeah, I was looking at some of the statistics the other day. I think it was like many hundreds, perhaps almost 1,000 people have been killed by the police so far this year, and we're not far into the year.
And actually with mentally ill people of color specifically, Saeed is number 10 in 2018.
Yeah, so the police have a license to be judge, jury, and executioner. Shoot first, ask questions later, or not. But, you know, I was also looking at a CNN story about, CNN is basically defending the cops. And they make the point, and I think this is, I could be wrong, Kirby, you tell me if I'm wrong. But they made the point that after he was shot, the police administered first aid to Saeed Vassil, the man they had just shot. But what I saw was the police, while he's lying in a pool of blood, I thought they had handcuffed him.
You're not wrong. And they absolutely are lying to the media. The media is doing its job of creating and pushing out lies to justify the murder of Saeed, just like they do every time somebody is murdered by the police. Saeed was approached, and the community has attested to this. I believe in the community. I trust the community. I know that the community is telling the truth with recordings, with eyewitness accounts. The police were called. There were 391 calls. The police refused to release the audio of those calls. The family, that's one of the demands that the family has and the community has, because people are sure that those calls were made by not anyone from the community, because there's apprehension of people of color with police in the first place. They wouldn't call the police in for any conflict, usually. That the calls were coming in from people who are not part of the community, who just moved into the community. And four police officers, three plainclothes officers, came up on Saeed in an unmarked vehicle, did not identify themselves, and they went on to shoot Saeed, fired 19 shots, 10 hit his body, 2 hit him in the face. So 8 to his body, 2 in the face. People were saying in video, give him CPR, let us get to him. and folks were trying to get to Saeed's body, and police were pushing people away. In fact, and this is how you know that Saeed had a relationship with the community, and even how police have been in conflict with this man and oppressing this man. There are community members who told us, just like what you were saying before, that Saeed was tasered by the police not too long ago, that they knew him, and then now this week, they murdered him.
I'm looking at a list. Kirby Joseph is our guest. We're talking to Kirby from New York City. She's been in the Crown Heights neighborhood where Saeed Vassell was killed a couple days ago. She's been out in the streets with the community, big demonstrations. I'm looking just at the names of the people, some of them who were very well known for a while, and then they became sort of unknown because the media stopped paying attention. So many people killed by the police in New York City. A Daily News investigation found that at least 179 people were killed by on-duty NYPD officers over the past 15 years. But I'm looking at the name of people I know the case you were involved in intimately, Akee Gurley, Eric Garner, Kamani Gray, Tamon Robinson, Ramarley Graham, Muhammad Ba, Chantel Davis, John Collado, Sean Bell, Tim Stansberry, Patrick Dorisman, and of course, next year will be the 20th anniversary of the killing of West African immigrant Amadou Diallo, who was shot 41 times when he was stood in his apartment building. He was doing nothing. They just rolled up on him and executed him, 41 shots. I mean, it's an epidemic of police murder in New York. Talk about Akee Gurley real quick. We have about 2 minutes left.
Akee Gurley was murdered November 20th, 2014 in the Pink Houses complex in East New York, Brooklyn. He was coming down the staircase, and as we know, one of the things that police also do, which is illegal to do, which NYSA enables police to do, so we see the connection there, that police officers are doing illegal vertical patrols up and down these buildings, and so with their guns drawn. And so Peter Liang went into a building corridor where Akai was coming down the stairs with his friend, Melissa Butler. And because he felt frightened, supposedly, he shot into the stairwell. Akai was shot from the seventh, stumbled down to the fifth. Peter Liang saw Akai gasping for his life in a pool of blood. He refused to administer CPR and instead called his union representative. As we know, the NYPD has the strongest union in the state. And we know why, because they're committing this epidemic on oppressed people. And he had an argument with his partner about calling the union rep for 10 minutes while Akai laid there dying. And I just want to say one thing about police shootings, just in terms of with the trial that I learned. When we went on trial, the people who were brought up to testify were not only witnesses who administered CPR to Akai because the police officers refused to, that were on duty. The folks that trained NYPD officers came and said, the officer that teaches gun safety and how to shoot said very clearly that a NYPD gun, a police gun, can fall on the ground and it will not go off because of safety. You need exactly 11 pounds of pressure to pull a police officer's gun's trigger to release a shot. So that means when we're hearing stories about people like Amadou being shot 40 times, about Saeed being shot at 19 times and then 10 hitting his body, a man in his mid-30s who was murdered in front of his teenage son, for you to shoot that gun and aim at these people and kill them, you mean to do it. It's not an accident.
Well stated. John, it's just it's America right now. The police have the license to kill.
What's so deeply troubling to me, Brian, is that we have transitioned into this period in our history where it's okay for the police to just murder people with impunity. And the only people who are in the streets are the people from that community who are directly affected, or activists like you and me. Every American should be in the street when something like this happens, because this is not an accident. The police are trained to shoot to kill. You know, I've gone through weapons training myself, and I was always taught that you should only draw your gun if you intend to kill somebody. That's the problem right there.
Yep. Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New York by Kirby Joseph. Kirby is an activist and an organizer deeply involved in the issue of human rights, social justice, fighting against police brutality. In the Akai Gurley case that Kirby was just talking about, she was a lead organizer and activist with the family seeking justice. But we're out of time. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're going to stay with this story. Right now, we have to take a break. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Thousands of Arizona teachers took to the streets yesterday threatening to go on strike if the state legislature does not improve teachers' pay and working conditions, reduce class sizes, and purchase new textbooks and equipment. Teachers in Arizona are among the worst paid in the country. We're witnessing a wave of teacher activism and strikes. We're joined from Arizona by Noah Carvalhas. He is a public educator in Phoenix, and he frequently publishes and speaks about public education and democracy in the United States. Noah, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. These are exciting times for people who are involved in education, the struggle for education, and it is a struggle. We've been covering what happened in West Virginia, the very successful Wildcat strike. Now, of course, Oklahoma teachers are still on strike and have been all week. Talk about what's going on in Arizona.
Yeah, so we're seeing Arizona continue to escalate actions. As you mentioned, we're some of the worst paid in the nation. Our elementary school teachers, like myself, are the very worst paid in the nation. And so we're organized now and we're mobilized. We have a group of over 40,000 members organized within a group we're calling Arizona Educators United, and we're continuing to take actions, formalizing our demands, all sorts of things right now, and really taking serious action.
So let's just talk about the structure or the organizational structure of what you're doing. Do you have a collective bargaining agreement now?
No, we don't right now in Arizona. We're a right-to-work state, so our union doesn't have that right here. What we've done in terms of negotiating is there's a representative team. So I'm representing Arizona Educators United. We have two people from our education association, our union here, on that team as well. And we've made a formal outreach to the governor to begin those negotiations.
And teachers are paying dues. Do you pay dues to the union?
You do pay dues to the union. Our group is not. You don't pay dues or anything. It's just it's really essentially a Facebook group that's grown and been mobilized and become a sort of an organization now.
Well, that's interesting and not unusual, in fact, in places where it's been very hard for unions to gain traction, of course, in right-to-work states. And some of the right-to-work places exist in states where it's not a right-to-work state, but the enterprise itself has an open shop. You have to use all kinds of tactics to both recruit people, motivate people. You can't rely on just a dues checkoff. What's the mood, though? What's the mood among teachers?
Oh, teachers are, it's hard to put just one word on it. They're fired up. They're frustrated. Their backs are against the wall. They feel like they've been pushed into a corner by our governor and our legislature, and something needs to change. They can't afford to live here anymore. So one of the things that's kind of become our motto out here is, I don't want to strike, but I will. And that's essentially the mood out here right now.
Yeah, indeed. And workers usually strike, unless they happen to be French workers, strike as a matter of last resort because you lose pay. There's a lot of danger. And of course, in a state where striking is illegal and there is no actual union rights, it's a precarious situation. So people have to be extremely motivated. And I'm wondering, because you are there and you've been doing this for a long time, is it what happened in West Virginia? Is it what happened in Oklahoma? In other words, is this part of a nationwide movement that's touching or igniting people in Arizona with a new hopefulness, perhaps?
I think it certainly is. I don't think you would have seen these discussions and actions taking place even 2 or 3 months ago, but West Virginia showed us what can happen, and they provided us an example, and they also gave us a framework of what it looks like to do this and to win. So certainly there's something much larger at play than just what's happening in whether it's one state in Oklahoma or West Virginia or here in Arizona. There's a nationwide movement, I think, taking place here.
I'm looking at a media outlet, the Phoenix Patch. The headline is, and this is from yesterday, Arizona teachers share photos of outdated books, broken equipment, Arizona, and then the subtitle is Arizona teachers among the lowest paid in the U.S. are sharing photos of outdated books and broken equipment to show working conditions. And then there's a big pile of patched together with duct tape American history books. They look like they're, I don't know, they're 50 years old.
Yeah.
And then the article quotes you, and I want to read a couple sentences from the article and then have you comment on it. The first sentence is, if you know a teacher, the chances are that you've heard a story of someone having to teach with outdated books in a classroom, of classrooms with broken chairs, of books being held together by duct tape in Arizona, where teachers are among the lowest paid in the country. They are fed up and want people to know what working conditions are like. Dozens of teachers in the state have been sharing pictures to let people know just how bad things are. Quote, the pictures are heartbreaking, a leader of Arizona Educators United, Noah Carvelis tells Patch. No one should have to work under these conditions. Are teachers actually paying out-of-pocket expenses to supplement or fill in the gaps, the holes for underfunded schools and underfunded classrooms?
I don't know a teacher who isn't, to tell you the truth. I don't know a single teacher who isn't. Most of them are paying, at the very least, I think about $200, I would guess, is the very least that I know of teachers spending on their classroom per year. And I know a lot of teachers who need to spend much more than that. I've heard a teacher spending $500, $600 to fill in these gaps. Because, you know, we got into this to provide for the kids and to try to help the kids. And that's just a part of the mentality of the people who go into education. So they can't go into the rooms and, you know, not let there be chairs or Kleenexes or paper towels. They go right into their own pockets to provide those things. And it really hits them hard financially. It's a difficult, difficult situation out here in Arizona.
Noah, what do you teach?
I teach music.
And what are the kids' ages?
Kindergarten through eighth grade.
Yeah. And how big are your class sizes?
You know, I'm pretty lucky out here. One of the things that my district does is they don't pay as much as some of the other districts in terms of salary. But what they do then is they can afford to bring on a couple extra teachers. So my class sizes are normally around 30, 28 to 30 is normally about where we're at. And I'm lucky for that. Out in other places, what they do is out here in Arizona, they pay you a little bit more, but then they'll essentially cut a teaching position and you'll have classes of 40 or 50 kids. So it's kind of a trade-off. Take a little less money and have a little bit smaller class size, or take a little bit more money and have a really huge class size. So I'm fortunate. But what happens is a lot of times teachers quit and the kids don't disappear. They go into other people's classes. So that happens really frequently. And then all of a sudden I'll have, like, my first year of teaching, the art teacher quit and her kids got split up into different classes. One of them was mine. So I'd have classes of 40, 45 kids some days. And we never replaced her. So that was my first year of teaching, was just humongous class sizes because teachers don't stay in this state. They leave.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I have to tell you, when you say you're lucky because your class size is 28 to 30, that's not nirvana. I mean, 28 to 30 is just a lot of kids, a whole lot of kids.
It really, really is. It's hard to even do your job when it's that many. You know, I got 7 keyboards in here right now looking at my classroom, and sometimes I have 30 eighth graders. I often have 38th graders and 7 keyboards doesn't work. You have to be really creative and flexible. And normally it means I'm essentially teaching 2 lessons at the same time.
Yeah. It's an amazing sacrifice. And just for our audience, how old are you?
I'm 23.
And how old is the, in general, the demographic of public educators and teachers in your school or in your district?
They're all about my age. We have some who are more veteran teachers. But what happens is you hit about, say, 30 years old, and you can't keep making $32,000 if you want to buy a house or you want to, you know, start a family. So they leave. They can't stay in this. So it's an interesting thing out here in Arizona. It caught me off guard when I first started teaching here, because everybody's basically fresh out of college, or nobody really has more than 3 or 4 years of experience, with the exception of a select few in most districts, because you can't afford to keep veteran teachers out here. Just they can't do it financially.
Yeah, I think we hear a little bit of musical activity in your background there.
Yeah, it's the kids are walking in to start the day here while we're talking, so they might catch some announcements and stuff.
That's good. That's good. You know, Noah, the state legislature, according to this article in the Phoenix Patch, determined last year that when adjusted for inflation, the state spends over $900 less per student than it did in 2008. I mean, it would seem to be going in the opposite direction of progress, because what you spend, how you spend, what the budget looks like really isn't about money. It's about policy and it's about priorities. Why is education taking the back seat in Arizona?
Well, it's you can look at what our governor does spend on. It's corporate tax cuts. He time and time again invests his money there, invests the state's money. I shouldn't say his money because it's really truly our money, our public dollars. It's tax cut after tax cut here. If you compare corporate taxes this last year to 2007, corporations are paying $600 million less annually than they did in 2007. So we have just, we're hemorrhaging public dollars because of all these tax cuts. And a lot of that we feel right here in education, where we continue to spend less and less so that these corporations don't have to pay taxes, essentially.
It's amazing and disgusting and all too true in so many parts of the country. Corporate profits coming first over the needs of the community, over the needs of children, and certainly over the needs of those who are sacrificing so much to teach our children. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Arizona by Noah Corvallis. He's a public teacher in Phoenix, and he frequently publishes and speaks about public education and democracy in the United States. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
3,100 employees of Google have signed a letter protesting that company's involvement in a Pentagon program that uses artificial intelligence to interpret video imagery that could be used to improve the targeting of drone strikes, or what Defense Secretary James Mattis calls the lethality of the U.S. military. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, welcome back to the show.
John and Brian, thanks for having me back.
Chris, this seems to me to be a very unusual event. Have you ever heard of 3,100 people of a commercial enterprise, something like Google, writing an open letter like this and protesting what really has to be a very lucrative market for its leaders?
No, this is a very unique and very striking example that these 3,100 plus Google employees are setting right now. They are, I will say, continuing in a long tradition of academics and students and researchers at some very famous institutions like UC Berkeley and Stanford and MIT, where some of the brightest minds in math and science are often recruited or attempted to be recruited by the NSA and by private companies like Raytheon. And students and researchers at those institutions often stand up to those recruitment efforts, knowing full well what the recruiters want from them. But this is something extremely different to see these employees who rely on Google for their paychecks standing up like this.
Chris, I'm looking at a copy of the letter that was published in one of the technology magazines just this week. It's a very short letter. It's only a page, and it starts off very directly. It's addressed to the CEO, and it says, "Dear Sundar, we believe that Google should not be in the business of war." And then at the very end of the letter, it asks for two things. It says here, "Recognizing Google's moral and ethical responsibility and the threat to Google's reputation, we request that you, one, cancel this project immediately, and two, draft, publicize, and enforce a clear policy stating that neither Google nor its contractors will ever build warfare technology." What do you make of this? Do you think that this has a chance of really happening?
I think so. I think this is straight and to the point. I very much appreciate the way the letter was framed. And I think if 3,100 employees have had the courage to sign on to this, I can only imagine that there are many, many more who have been waiting for an opportunity like this and observing to see what the response is before they also sign on. People who may have been afraid to lose their jobs or have some sort of other repercussion. I can't imagine that this is only 3,100 people, not to mention the broader public who is very concerned about the use of drones in warfare and here at home.
I hate to keep harping on this letter, but it's so well written and so direct. I have to quote one more paragraph. It says here, "This plan will irreparably damage Google's brand and its ability to compete for talent. Amid growing fears of biased and weaponized AI, artificial intelligence, Google is already struggling to keep the public's trust. By entering into this contract, Google will join the ranks of companies like Palantir, Raytheon, and General Dynamics. The argument that other firms like Microsoft and Amazon are also participating doesn't make this any less risky for Google. Google's unique history, its motto, 'Don't be evil,' and its direct reach into the lives of billions of users set it apart. You can't be any more direct than that. And to your point that you're surprised that only 3,100 people signed it, I would go even further and say, I bet the reason more people didn't sign it is because they didn't know it. They didn't know about it. Because this is one of these forks in the road for a company like Google. You're either going to be with the Pentagon or you're not.
Absolutely. You know, I find it very offensive. If you read the New York Times coverage of this, they said it was, quote, an idealistic stamp. Of course, the New York Times, being a mouthpiece of U.S. imperialism, is going to say that. You know, and whether this is or is not idealistic or realistic, it's a huge step. And I very much appreciate, actually, that the employees called out the Google motto, don't be evil, which is now the motto of Google's parent company. The question is, who do they not want to be evil to? And by they, I mean the executives at Google and Alphabet. Who don't they want to be evil to? They're a for-profit company. They're not responsible to their employees and to the public. They're actually responsible to their investors and shareholders. And I think that that language in this letter really signals that, Google, you have a responsibility to the people, not just to your shareholders and executives.
We have a military-industrial complex. It started, it didn't always exist. It didn't exist even before or even right after World War II. It only came into its permanence, its existence as an enduring part of the American political, economic, and not to mention military, and I would also say academic life of the country after or starting with the Korean War. And now this military-industrial complex has its own life. And as a consequence, the government spends, you know, what is it, maybe $1 trillion when you look at the money in totality for defense. Offense, defense, it's all called defense.
You right. know,
it's always for defense. But here, Google will come under another pressure. If the Google executives step away from Project Maven, which is this project
yes.
which coordinating with the Pentagon to make, as James Mattis, Mad Dog Mattis says, America's military to make it more lethal, enhance its lethality, as you said,
right.
John. If they step away, the Pentagon is going to punish Google. The reason for that is Pentagon doesn't want other companies to start to get the idea that it's okay to resist the entreaties of the military-industrial complex. And there are many, many other contracts that won't be offered to Google that will go to Google's competitors. And even though Google is very big, I mean, nobody's bigger as a high-tech company, Google also knows that they're just a big monopoly company, and over them is the 700-pound gorilla called the military-industrial complex or the Pentagon, which I would argue is the real power in America. I mean, it's the greatest power of all. Presidents come and go. You know, Donald Trump might come and go. But that military-industrial complex, that's not going anywhere. Go ahead, Chris.
Sure. You know, I do expect that if Google does pull out of Project Maven or even makes any signals in that direction, there's certainly going to be a tweet from Donald Trump about it, and the Pentagon will try to strike back at them, just like the FBI did when Apple refused to unlock the cell phone of the San Bernardino shooter a couple years ago. Ultimately, you know, I think that Google does a lot more business with the government than just Project Maven. Google is a partner in the PRISM program that we learned about through WikiLeaks, through Edward Snowden. And I certainly actually hope that we see people standing, the Google employees standing up to Google's collaboration with the NSA and other intelligence agencies as well. And that would pose a real threat to the company in the eyes of the government.
For the average observer like me, who's not a technologist, you're a technologist, I can see what Google can do for NSA. I'm not really clear on what it is Google can do for the Pentagon. Do you understand this technology at all? Can you explain it?
Sure. So my understanding of Project Maven is that Google will be providing hardware and software that will let the Pentagon quickly and automatically analyze footage from unmanned drones. Where are they flying? Over parts of Africa, over Yemen, over Syria, anywhere they deploy them to. And they will use that data analysis to see what they're about to be shooting at, essentially. The Pentagon was very quick to say that they wouldn't do any sort of automatic shooting based on just the data analysis. But ultimately, there's going to be a weapon deployed from the information gathered from these drones. And Google is going to be providing software and hardware to make that analysis smarter and faster.
Yeah, and just think back, everybody, because Google was going all around the country taking pictures of each of our neighborhoods and every street.
I forgot that.
They collected all that data. They have more data than probably the U.S. government. And that imagery has all been uploaded. It's been categorized. It's Google Maps.
I mean,
we rely—
Google Earth.
Google Earth, Google Maps. And, of course, the Pentagon wants that. Of course they want access to that. And, of course, I don't think they're going to stop. And that's what makes this kind of a—this is a David and Goliath battle. Yes, it's a lot of employees in Google, 3,100. And they have done something strong, and there is strength in numbers. But they're up against institutional power, perhaps the greatest power in the world. That's why I think it's extremely important that we're talking about this and not using the language of the New York Times that these are just idealists. Like, in order to be a realist, you have to be embracing the Pentagon. And to not embrace the Pentagon, to not want to have your work used to kill people, people you don't know, in countries you've never been, languages you don't speak, cultures you don't understand, religions that you don't know about. You don't want drone operators sitting in, you know, suburban Virginia blowing people away, including a lot of kids or their grandparents, which is exactly what happens. You don't want that, and thus you're being idealistic. What about just saying, thus you're being a human being? I mean, thus you're trying to resist something evil, because it is evil.
Completely agree with you, Brian. This goes against Google's supposed motto of don't be evil. But I think, too, we have to say that this, you know, it's not just 3,100 employees. We see mass anti-war movements every time the U.S. tries to go to war or does go to war. And so it's 3,100 employees joining with millions and millions of people across the country and across the world to oppose this.
There it is right there. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Graffa. We will be right back after this. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
We continue our conversation about Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, and personal data. Did Cambridge Analytica impact the 2016 election? We're joined from New Orleans by Dr. Robert Epstein. He is the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. And we're joined from Amsterdam by Bill Binney. He's a former NSA technical director who became a legendary national security whistleblower. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Dr. Epstein, I'm looking at your article on the Daily Caller. It's entitled, Cambridge Analytica is not the problem. Google and Facebook are the problem, with R being capitalized. Tell us why Google and Facebook are such a problem here.
Because what Cambridge Analytica does is competitive. It's I call it the billboard model. You put up your billboard, I put up my billboard, and sometimes they just cancel each other out. The point is there are hundreds, maybe thousands of companies that do what Cambridge Analytica does. But what Google and Facebook do, there's no one else who does what they do. Nobody. They take this content that's coming from thousands and thousands of sources, and they determine what you're going to see or not see. In other words, what they're going to censor. And they decide what order you're going to see the content in. And that's how you influence people. That's what the research I've been doing for more than 5 years now shows unequivocally. That's where the power is, filtering and ordering. That's how you influence people, and that's how you flip elections.
You say something that is absolutely fascinating in this article. You say that Cambridge Analytica purchased 5,000 data points on each person, apparently these 87 million people at least. And you say the groundwork had access to Google's entire database, hundreds of thousands of digital facts about each of us, including our search histories and emails. So much information, in fact, that Google could have likely computed the election results days before Election Day. Although Google obviously screwed up on its Electoral College calculations, Clinton won the popular vote by nearly 3 million, almost certainly with Google's help. That seems to me to be a troubling thing about the future of our elections and our democracy, does it not?
Oh, I find it extremely troubling, but I have no doubt that Google alone, has the information and the computing power to know precisely who's going to vote and who they're going to vote for. As I say, they obviously did some miscalculating again, But, you know, the conservative historian, Neil Ferguson, who you might have had on your show for all I know, but he's now at the Hoover Institution, was at Harvard before that. You know, what he's been saying over and over again in recent months, they will never, and when, by they, he means Google and Facebook, they will never make those mistakes again. Whatever mistakes they made in 2016, they will never make those mistakes again.
Bill Binney, these companies have thousands, hundreds of thousands of points of data on each of us. Aside from the obvious, what we're talking about here, which is targeted advertising for political campaigns, is there any legitimate reason why these companies should have and hold this information?
Aside from advertising, no. In fact, I thought all the data on citizens, for example, in the United States, that they should pass a law that's saying you could not hold that data for any long period of time. Give them a short period, like a week or so. And otherwise, they should needing to purge their database. That also should be the law for the intelligence community. Unless they have a warrant for a U.S. citizen, they need to purge the data that they're storing in their storage facilities.
Yeah, we need an audit to find out just what's happening with the
there's
creation.
There's that dirty word.
Yeah, with the creation. It's a national surveillance state, but then the architecture in the so-called private market, free market, privately owned, profit-driven market, they also have their own surveillance apparatus of equal size, in fact.
No, I don't think it's equal size. See, they don't have the action. They don't have access to the public switch telephone network, transactional relationships, or the internet transactional relationships, except for the ones that they manage, like Gmail for Google, you know, but other email services Google doesn't have, but NSA does.
Okay, so that's an important distinction. I want to thank you for bringing that out. So in other words, the government, NSA in particular, and then all the derivative agencies or agencies that derive their data from NSA or much of it, they have data on everybody. Will the government then too know exactly how people will vote? Or in other words, they're aggregating. Facebook is what Dr. Epstein is saying is Facebook, for instance, or Google can, through aggregating all of these data points, know exactly what our behavior will be or what it will be under additional stimulation or influence. The government thus could do the same.
Yes, it could. But I certainly don't have a great deal of confidence in them being able to construct something that would accurately reflect what people are going to do. They might have some idea, but it's going to be, in my view, a very hit or miss kind of algorithm that they've got.
But, you know, the government, at least in theory, is accountable to the public. These two private companies are accountable only to their shareholders. That's a big difference. And, I don't think that Bill is going far enough here. You know, he's saying, oh, yeah, let them collect the data, but they've got to erase it now and then. Well, you know what? They would never erase it. It would always exist in multiple backups, always accessible to them. They never erase anything. But I want to go farther. I think that the surveillance business model, where we're the product that's being sold, should be illegal. I don't think that model is a legitimate model. And just a couple days ago, Tim Cook, the head of Apple, came out publicly and said the same thing. He called that model of doing business creepy.
Yes, he did. In fact, he was asked how he would have handled it if he had been the CEO of Facebook. And he said, if I were the CEO of Facebook, we would have never done this in the first place.
I don't disagree, but, you know, that's why I don't do Facebook or anything on the web like that. I never say I like anything because I don't like to give away any indication of how I think.
I think, Bill, that you're underestimating the extent of the reach, not so much of Facebook, but of Google's reach, because they're monitoring people now, not just through Gmail and search history. They're monitoring now over 200 different platforms. They're in the middle of a big campaign trying to convince everyone to put their Google Home device in every room of their house, and the Home device listens 24/7.
Yeah, but see, there's basically two systems of communications for people in the world. One is the public switch telephone network, which is the landline, cell phone, satellite phone network that is numbered unique around the world. And the other is the internet. There's two different systems in terms of what they do to communicate, one using IPs and IPv4 and 6, and the other using phone numbers. They're different systems, and they're communicating. They can be in separate portions of the same fiber optic lines, but one does not have to sessionize the public switch telephone network.
But if there's a Google Home device in your kitchen, your living room, and your den, you know what? You don't need to be cutting into phone lines. You can hear everything.
Yeah, but I'm saying NSA has every access to every phone record or every phone call in the United States and pretty much most of the world.
Let me ask you, Bill Binney, what's NSA's relationship or attitude or approach towards Google and Facebook?
Well, for example, they use the muscular program to tap between the data centers when they transfer data to backup. Yahoo and Google didn't know it, but they were tapped unilaterally by NSA, and they were taking in all their data, whereas they were playing this game with the PRISM program up front, trying to say that they and use this as a charade to say, here, we're conforming with the law here. We have a warrant and we're going for data on the PRISM program, requesting it directly from the companies, and they give it to us. So that was their charade to say we're complying with the law, when in fact in the background under the upstream program, they had over 100 and some taps in the fiber optic lines inside the United States, where they're taking in everything, and hundreds of staffs around the world where they're taking in most of that too. So that what they're saying in public is not what they're doing in secret. And that's really what's going, that's really where the problem is.
Dr. Epstein, in the last minute that we have, is there any way for Americans to protect themselves short of what Bill Binney just said a moment ago, just not having an account with any of these platforms?
I think at one time that was actually a pretty effective measure, but it's no longer an effective measure because if you have a cell phone, for example, even when you're offline, that cell phone is recording information, location information, for example, continuously. And the moment you connect to your wireless network or Wi-Fi, either one, you know, all that information is instantly uploaded to Google if you have an Android phone. So it's getting tougher and tougher to go off grid, as they say, because you're being monitored through more and more means, more methods, which most people are just unaware of. There are things you can do, but you know it takes work, effort, a little bit of money, and the vast majority of people are just never going to go there.
You know, I want to say one last thing too, Brian. Most Americans either don't know or forget during the course of the day that these devices we have in our homes, Alexa, Siri, whatever they're called, that we're now being encouraged to put in every room, law enforcement is able to subpoena those devices and can go back and listen to what we've been saying in our own homes, in the privacy of our own homes, to then use against us, something that we ought to be concerned about. But we're out of time, so I gave the last word to myself. Sorry. We were joined from New Orleans by Dr. Robert Epstein. He's the senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. And we were joined from Amsterdam by Bill Binney. He's a former NSA technical director and legendary national security whistleblower. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can now follow us on Twitter, @LoudClearRadio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m., on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. La 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 la